On this day in 2007, former Smiths guitarist Johnny Marr was made a visiting professor of music at the University of Salford in Manchester for changing the face of British guitar music. The former Smiths guitarist was set to deliver a series of workshops in his jangly Rickenbacker Fender guitar playing. Telecaster guitar playing became synonymous with the Smiths sound. Marr was voted fourth best guitarist of the last 30 years in a poll conducted a few years ago in BBC. And Phil Alexander, editor-in-chief of Mojo, described his playing as arguably Britain's last great guitar stylist, and I'm sure an inspiration for many Kiwi bands along the way. Either of you a big Smiths fan?
Well, you've finally mentioned a musical name that I know and actually have listened to quite a bit.
And actually like,
although there have been some rather difficult political developments in Smithland in more recent years. No, I have had many a pre-legalisation moment in the ancient past. Well, an occasional, I wouldn't say many.
There's a tweet.
I love a good guitar riff, and it's, you know, there's some classics in there.
He's got a unique style, hasn't he?
Yeah. It's one of those things I've always wished that I could do, is play the guitar. But
No,
I'm one of those Māori people who can't.
I'm a guitar player from way back, but I haven't maintained it. What about you, Lila?
I'm musically hopeless, but fortunately I have a very talented pair of Gene Parcells, who are both fabulous guitarists.
Wonderful.
I've introduced them to the Smiths too.
Very good, very good. 25 to 5, the panel, Lila Harai, Scott Campbell with us. A huge response on whether you think that the Greens should be part of government or not. Here's just two or three. Strongly believe the Greens should be offered a continuation of present arrangement. Without a progressive spine, Labour risk treading water for 3 years and losing next time. Mike says, absolutely the Greens need to be there, playing too hard to the middle as trying to please everyone and nobody. Swing voters are too fickle to count on long term. Les says, no way. No Greens in government. That's why Labour got a huge majority. Another one, nope, the people have spoken. Greens are in opposition, not in cabinet. Let's see if Jacinda has the courage to say no. In other news, very interesting item about women in the investment and banking industry. They're calling for changes to KiwiSaver to make it fairer too for women, looking at an article by Rob Stock in Stuff. And that while men and women have similar rates of KiwiSaver membership, data from the Commission for Financial Capability shows that women are more likely not to be making regular savings. Social justice campaigner and economist Susan St. John says part of KiwiSaver have been designed with a male lens. Susan St. John is Associate Professor of Economics at the University of Auckland Business School and Director of the Retirement Policy and Research Centre, and is with us now. Kia ora, Susan.
Kia ora, Wallace.
Look, tell us what parts, very interesting article this one, what parts of KiwiSaver have been designed with a quote-unquote male lens?
Well, I guess that was a bit of an overstatement, but traditionally superannuation schemes have been based on the male life cycle of paid work, 40 years in the paid workforce, etc., and they have not served the needs of women well. Now, we have got something in KiwiSaver that is a light year away from that kind of traditional scheme. And when we compare ourselves to what happens in other countries, New Zealand women are particularly fortunate, not just in the design of KiwiSaver, but also having the basic state pension that's non-contributory and universal and at a decent level. So let's not overstate that issue of the male lens, but nevertheless, it's interesting when you look at the design of KiwiSaver and you see that actually there still are elements in there of that male design. So, for example, the auto-enrolment period is between 18 and 65. Now, that's fine, but within that period is when men are going to be working their 40 years. Women, on the other hand, many of them will take 10, 15 years out of the workforce and maybe come back later in life, maybe not even till they're 60. And so they miss out on a large number of years of employer contribution and of the government contribution, unless they've been able to contribute themselves while they're out of the workforce. And this is where the signals are not very strong, and many women are in households where it's simply just not affordable for them to continue right. when they're not working.
All right, so there was one idea I found it quite interesting, actually. One idea was, and I'll bring the panellists in very shortly, one idea was to introduce what could be called care credits, quote-unquote, so people were not penalised for time out of employment, for example.
Yes, that's quite a lot more difficult than you think to actually design it. So, for example, it might be suggested that when you're getting paid parental leave, that you should be able to get contributions made on your behalf. But who's actually making those contributions? The taxpayer is the one that's funding the paid parental leave. How does it work with the government contribution? These are quite tricky issues and certainly not resolved very well in other countries either. So maybe it might be more fruitful in the first instance to look at things like the reintroduction of the Kickstart, which was highly beneficial to women who might start out with very small balances.
$1,000.
That was $1,000. And it was removed without any gender analysis or distributional analysis, and really has to be seen as quite bad for women and low-income people in general.
Let's go around the panel. Lila, have you got a thought or a comment on this particular issue?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's any kind of policy or program that is linked to income from paid work is going to be more beneficial on average to men than to women. So, yeah, I think the point that Susan makes, which is that when you look at that, that underlines the importance of our non-contributory universal national superannuation scheme, not just to women, but to anyone who experiences low pay or periods out of the paid workforce. But I think it's really great that people are kind of highlighting these issues, because actually an awful lot of our public resource is, you know, men benefit more from than women because of the earnings they have, but also because of behaviours. So, for instance, the accident compensation scheme, last time I looked at it, over 70% of the payments out of the scheme were to men, including from the non-work account. So from, you know, accidents, sporting accidents or car accidents or whatever. So, it is really important to apply a gender lens to these things. It doesn't necessarily mean you can reshape every policy, but you have to find other policies that meet the needs of the other groups.
I'll bring Susan back in, then Scott. Susan.
Yes, I totally agree with those sentiments. And when we think about the worker procreation, Lila, and you think about the long-term effects that many women suffer in their 50s and 60s, because of their productive work in procreation, and that's not picked up by ACC in any satisfactory way. So, yes, there is an unconscious bias in many of our social programs. And when we think about KiwiSaver, I don't have any evidence to support this, but one would expect that in the time of COVID, it was the woman's KiwiSaver balances that were looked at first, if there was applications for withdrawal for hardship, for example, or for savings suspension. And once women go down that track of getting out of the scheme or stopping contributions, then it's very hard for them to get back in and to make up that lost time.
Scott.
Yeah, I think really interesting subject, and good to have it being talked about, absolutely. And I think maybe the ACC one's just because we're a bit more careless, and that's why. I know I've got a lot of ACC numbers.
You cost us a lot of money,
unfortunately.
You bloke.
One of the things that did pop up for me was the life expectancy one, and I know that there have been calls in particular from Māori and Pacifica communities about a look at KiwiSaver because of that reason, because the Māori life expectancy is a lot less. And once you get into that 65-year bracket, that is, based on statistics, the end of life expectancy for Māori. So I think I agree. You could probably put the lens of a whole bunch of different things on
this. All right. Yeah. Well, here's a text for you all. As a stay-at-home mother, my KiwiSaver, age 50, is less than $20,000, whereas my husband's is well over $330,000. A house is in a family trust. My earning potential is limited. Divorce, should I want to, is not an economic option. So there you go. But look, I just want to bring in this what to do in terms of what could be done in the next 3 years, perhaps. That $1,000 kickstart, so that was abolished, what, in 2015, I think?
2015,
yeah.
Yes.
So might that be one way to actually solve all the issues here, but that's one starting point?
It is. It's a signal. And unfortunately, it's really hard to design tax incentives as such that don't end up being pro-better off or pro-male. And so, yes, we've got to design things that actually recognise the special situation that many, many women find themselves in. And
so
it's
Susan,
all very well sitting in a marriage where you know that your partner's going to be able to split that if you divorce, but that's not giving you autonomy and control over your own circumstances
so
that many
what
women
might
want.
What might the answer be then, without sort of the government finding a new bucket of money somewhere? What could an answer be to it?
A new bucket of money? Well, I think we've got an extremely good basic structure for our superannuation policies, and there isn't much money necessarily involved in improving the design of KiwiSaver. Reintroducing the $1,000, we've already got 3 million people in KiwiSaver, so if it were only for new people coming in, then that would not be particularly expensive. Money is there to do good policy.
Okay. Nice to have you on the program, Susan. I appreciate it. Susan St. John, an Associate Professor of Economics at the University of Auckland Business School. It is 15 away from 5. The panel are NZ National. Thank you very much for all your responses regarding whether or not you'd like to see the Greens in the coalition. We'll try and get to a couple of those before the end of the program. About half the contents of landfill should not go there, says waste educator Kate Meads. Kate holds corporate seminars, public presentations, and works with councils, has done for the last few years now, about food and other waste-related topics. And over the weekend, she held a waste-free living workshop in Dunedin. Now, according to the Otago Daily Times, she gave the attendees a reality check about waste in this country. Kate Meads, kia ora, welcome to the panel.
Hello, how are you?
I'm very good, thank you. And a lot of the stuff we kind of know, don't we? But it was actually a big reminder to a lot of us that, in fact, you were saying here, much of the material inside a landfill, even if normally considered biodegradable, doesn't break down for a long, long time.
No, that's right. And it's quite interesting because a lot of the waste that is going to landfill every week is food waste and green waste, and it's something that they really don't want in there because it's totally avoidable. And also, there's quite a high percentage of recycling too, stuff that could be recycled that goes to landfill every week as well.
Mm. So it's not a new issue, is it? But how are we doing? How are Kiwis doing? And how are councils in general responding to this message?
It's really interesting because there was some stats that came out a couple of years ago that said within 3 years our waste to landfill had actually increased by 20%. And
wow.
So we're not doing so well.
Right.
And also, from my perspective, especially as a consumer, sort of learnt a bit of stuff about waste and reducing waste, I don't believe it's the council's fault that it's a problem. It's certainly the councils are doing everything they can to reduce waste to landfill, but they can't control the consumers' buying habits.
Okay.
And so it's sort of that's why they, I suppose, aren't quite well supported to get the message out to help people just rethink what they actually buy in the first place.
On that, and I'll bring the panellists in soon, but one, can I bring up an issue that is close to my heart perhaps, and that is this issue of disposable nappies. As I understand it, I'm just looking at an actual Auckland Council piece on this. It's a huge issue, these disposable nappies.
Oh, it's massive. There's about a million single-use disposable nappies go to landfill every day in New Zealand.
No. Yeah, really?
Yeah, every day. Yeah. And it's like for a minimal four-hour use, maybe sometimes you might get 8 hours out of them, but generally, you know, up to 4 hours, and then they go into landfill and they're potentially there for up to 1,000 years, which is quite frightening.
Okay.
It's a massive issue.
Scott.
So, given, like Wallace was saying, that this is not necessarily a new issue, we know about this, but is it a culture change that's needed, and do we need to do it sooner? Because are we just producing sort of more bad stuff, or are we just getting lazy and just chucking it in the red bin, not the blue one or the green one?
I think that it has been a culture change. So we've got to a point now where our culture is quite different even from 15 years ago. When, like, think back to before you could buy a bottle of water, we used to just fill our drink bottles out of the tap. But now it's quite often people just buy a bottle of water, which is sort of a little bit weird if you think about the big picture of it. Also, things like single-use takeaway coffee cups, they were never a thing that was ever needed to be dealt with, but now we've got 295 million of them a year in New Zealand. Packaging, you know, we never used to package any produce, but now, you know, you go into the supermarket and it's literally like spot the unpackaged thing. Our culture's changed, and we really need to change it back, because the reality is we're placeholders on the planet. We inherited it from our grandparents, and now our kids coming in are going to have a massive mess to tidy up after us if we don't start changing
things. I'm still actually reeling on that little fact there, a million disposable nappies a day in New Zealand. Lila, what's your thoughts on this?
I think the work that waste educators do and, you know, community waste organisations around the country do is just really, really important. And I expect that, you know, that also the advocacy work they do for regulation is critical, because, you know, they can promote all the kind of good behaviour and the rest of it. But if you don't have kind of regulatory systems that are also aimed at reducing waste being generated or increasing the reuse or recycling of waste, then it's a bloody hard task. And
to just change your mind in the supermarket. What do you make of that, Kate, the regulatory aspect alongside the education?
Oh, absolutely. I think if we are not able to bring in products that create a problem, then that solves like half the problem. Then you literally can't get the product. And so I think regulation is absolutely part of the answer. And I also think that, you know, we just need to shift to rethinking. I often, like within my work, a lot of people feel like they have to do everything, otherwise they feel like they're not achieving. Whereas my key is to get people to just rethink even just one thing they can change, because it's so hard now, people get really overwhelmed. So if we can just have a little thought about, you know, okay, if you are a takeaway coffee cup user, maybe you could just go to a reusable cup, and then you make one change, and it's quite significant over the time.
I can recall all those years ago, Lila Hare, when bottled water wasn't a thing. You'd actually put your mouth against a tap and you drink.
Yeah, and actually some
primary school.
Exactly.
Some of us dinosaurs still do. I carry a little Ziploc plastic bag with me.
Full of
when
water.
When I'm running or I'm out walking and I stop at a petrol station or a park and I fill my little bag up and I have my drink and I tuck it back in my pocket and it's the lightest, easiest way of transporting your water.
That's a good tip.
Yeah.
Can you put coffee in it?
I'm a reusable coffee person now.
Okay, it's all good. We're doing the guilt now, Kate, so we've got a reusable coffee cup. Asking for a friend, hand up. If anybody can give me tips about how to transition from disposable nappies to cloth nappies, and is it quite the challenge or not?
I went the other way. I had cloth nappies the first time round. Not me personally. I'm sure I had cloth nappies. But my first child, I did the cloth nappy thing, the laundry thing. I went back to work after 3 months, and it was bloody exhausting. And the second time round, it was disposables all the way. So I have no judgments to make there.
Fair enough.
But the reality is the cloth nappies nowadays are a lot easier than what they used to be. So it's literally like putting on a disposable nappy. There's no folding, no soaking or things like that. And the other good thing with cloth nappies, and this is where I've had a lot of people who, having their third child, have started using cloth nappies because disposables cost them a fortune. Mm. You're looking at $5,000 per child, which is insane.
What?
Really?
Yeah, whereas your cloth nappies, you're like maximum, including your washing costs, you'd be looking at $1,500 for one child. And if you got to use them for more than one child, then you can save quite a lot of money.
And you need to do some homework. Yeah. Hey, Kate, we've got to move on, but I really appreciate your time.
All right.
Thank you very much for being with us today. Kate Meads there. The number to text 2101. You can email the panel at rnz.co.nz. Well, each week on the panel, we introduce you to a small New Zealand business and check in on how they're doing during these tough economic times. Today, we're talking to Helava Homeware Designs, a family-run Auckland business who offer cultural-styled homeware for all ages. And the owner wanted children to connect in some way with each of their cultures, Tongan, Samoan, Māori. Currently on the website, they are selling beanbags and kids' sofas with very bright floral prints. Sandra Hofano from Helava is with us now. Kia ora, Sandra.
Kia ora, Wallace. How are you?
I'm well. I've got you on because these remind me of being growing up in an island household of the very, very, very bright floral designs that my nana used to insist on having splashed all around the lounge. I think many people can relate, but this is the sort of thing that you do in a way, those beautiful bright prints.
Yes, absolutely, yeah.
Tell us about it.
So, like you said, we're a small business. We've literally just started up in the past 4 weeks, so coming out of that second lockdown. And we were just purely inspired by the fact that my own children, they are quarter Māori, quarter Tongan, quarter Samoan, and quarter Kiwi. So I always thought, you know, how am I going to teach our children about their culture, you know? So we just came up with the idea of producing homeware that has cultural patterns.
Mm. And how was it starting up a new business, you know, 4 weeks in, and also particularly, you know, in this time of lockdown?
I just feel like we had the Kiwi attitude, you know, just continue on, try new things, and just keep on going. Out of the first lockdown, I just had a baby as well, so it was pretty hectic, but we just ran with it, really.
Lila's looking at the designs right now.
They're beautiful.
They're pretty cool,
eh? Yeah, extremely beautiful. Congratulations.
How do you say the name?
Yeah. So the name is Helava.
Helava. And yeah. In terms of that cultural aspect, can you explain a bit more about it? Because to those who mightn't know, perhaps a bit of the background between some of these sort of, they're not all florals, but the bright prints, very engaging.
Yeah, so a lot of the cultural patterns, they show stories about our ancestors, or they're symbolic of particular meanings. The word Helava itself comes from the language of Rotuma. So Rotuma is an island off the coast of Fiji. So the English meaning of that word is Helava, is beautiful. So we strive to really, you know, show off those patterns and encourage, cultural connection.
Mm. They're really beautiful. What have you found, given that you've been in this for 4 weeks now, what's been one of your greatest challenges, but then also the thing that's got you up every day to continue doing this?
The first thing for me is just passion. I think when you have something, it's just worth getting up for. You kind of just want to finish sleeping so that you can get up. So that's been one of my biggest drives, really. It's just is my love for the culture and wanting to ensure that my children feel the same way. And one of the hardest things is coordinating. So we have a team of three. They're all sitting here with me, and that's been a challenge, like delegating and making sure everything gets done quickly. So yeah.
Quick question for Sandra.
Yeah, are you Rotuman? Are you from Rotuma?
No, so my kids are, and also my oldest, the oldest grandchild on my husband's family, they've also got connections to Rotuma as well.
Wow. And who does the manufacturing? Are you sewing them yourselves?
Yes, so my beautiful mother-in-law does it all.
Wow.
What's your website?
Yeah. So the website is www.helava.co.nz.
Sandra, it's a wonderful, it's a privilege to have you on the panel. Thank you very much your time.
Thank you.
And all the best. 4 weeks in, eh? Helava.co.nz. Very, very cool indeed. Lila Harrow, Scott Campbell. Thank you so much for being with me. It has been wonderful.